Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast. Welcome to Season 2, Issue 12 of the Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast. This is the last in this series. The Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast series will return with Season 3, hopefully later in the year. This issue we farewell The World's Last Wonder with Chapters 13 and 14. First published in 1901 in the Tocsin newspaper in Melbourne, Australia, this story contains a lot of firsts. The first modern space opera of Australia. The first time the word scientist is used in an Australian science fiction story. The first appearance of an airlock in a science fiction story. Discussions of thinner atmospheres, the problems of weightlessness, and other scientific space facts not commonly used in science fiction until years later. Even a deep understanding of the effects of gravity in space, something even modern space operas and space fictions have difficulty conveying correctly. And the first appearance of a realistic alien first contact situation. Thanks to The World's Last Wonder, we can pinpoint the beginning of modern science fiction in Australia as early 1901. And now, the final two chapters. Enjoy!
Chapter 13. The difficulty in the way of exchanging ideas disappeared shortly after the finish of this open-air breakfast, for we then accompanied our hosts to their observatory, where we found a visitor who was an expert in language. We have on Earth and in Melbourne men who can interpret at first sight a language that they never learned, better than most can do after some months of study, who can decipher a cryptogram with more ease than many can read a doctor's prescription, by a great deal. But although such men have often certain peculiarities and eccentricities, yet their appearance is, after all, very much like that of other people. This expert was unlike any person any of us had ever seen on Earth, and so utterly unlike that at first we did not suppose him to be a person at all. In order to reach the observatory, we had to walk for about half a mile. The long confinement in the car, where there was no room for exercise, and where, for a great part, or the way there was no perceptible weight in our bodies, or in anything, so that we had always to move most gingerly, had cramped us so much that, on first coming out onto the soil, we had maintained the same sort of feeble movement. But by this time we had begun to recover the earthly action of our limbs, and as the circulation of blood became more vigorous, we found it difficult to avoid putting something like the same amount of power into each stride as if we had been walking in our own world. Weight on Mars, however, is so much less than on the Earth that whenever we lapsed into our terrestrial walking action, we leapt and bounced like acrobats, much to the surprise of our Martian companions, who, being provided with very slender legs proportioned to the smaller weight of masses on Mars, walked as steadily and gravely as we had been in the habit of doing when we were on Earth. Coming in this extraordinary fashion to the observatory, whilst a bewildered crowd watched our capers as if we were a circus, we seated ourselves in a room and were endeavouring to give and receive such information as could be conveyed by maps and obvious signs, when there came a tapping at the door. One of the Martians opened it, and, notwithstanding that we had been somewhat prepared by a previous experience, we were certainly startled at seeing a huge spider come in. He quite justified the description that I had heard as to size, being very nearly as big as a bullock, and his appearance was terrifying. But the Martians who were with us went up and appeared to welcome him quite cordially. They pointed us out to him, and one of them actually led him up to me. My natural nervousness was relieved when he began to make signs and point to maps and globes. He had evidently been given to understand that I was the chief spokesman, and had been told what I had already been able to make our hosts understand concerning ourselves and our planet. He took one of the recording machines from the human-seeming Martians, and placing it side by side with a specimen of my writing, proceeded to draw out from himself a thread of coarse web, which he wove rapidly, producing an arrangement of knots and lines, which I understood to answer the purpose of writing. I was able to imitate the design easily with a pencil and paper, and he succeeded very well in imitating my written words by means of his web. Thus, we had at once the basis of a dictionary, for by putting down the signs corresponding to things or actions which could be clearly indicated by gestures, we got the clue to numerous signs in each other's books, where a known sign often helps to suggest the meaning of an unknown one occurring in the context. Thus, supposing I were now to write down 12, 3, 4, 5, 6, and that I explained to you by gestures that 1 meant me, 2 meant go, 4 the earth, and 6 Mars, you would have no difficulty in judging that 3 and 5 meant from and to respectively, and in reading the sentence as I went from the earth to Mars. The human-seeming Martians relied on their vibration recorders, which copied the quiverings of their proboscis or antennae and imparted them afresh to other proboscis. Therefore, they did not have any language of signs and would have needed not only to learn our signs of writing, but to get used to dealing in signs at all. Whereas the spiders, who as I now began to perceive were not mere creatures as on Earth, but people, had become perfectly familiar with written, or rather knitted, language, as well as being able to use their feelers, so that it was them and not those inhabitants who in form most resembled us, on whom we had chiefly to rely. This fact, coupled with the flag incident already mentioned, was the occasion of our quitting Mars in quicker time than the amicable relation so far subsisting had given any hint of, so that we were not able to acquire much knowledge before we had to leave. The circumstances of our expulsion, for which the blame rests not on us but on Fisher and Sir Mark Solomon, though they had already fled from the planet, will be related in another chapter. Chapter 14. For something over a week I devoted myself to the company of the Spider Martian, by which time we were both able to converse intelligibly and with some facility in writing. The others of our party took short strolls, seeing what they could see, but they were at the great disadvantage of not being able to ask questions or receive answers except by means of pictures. I was interpreter for them to the spider, and he in turn acted as interpreter between me and the men Martians, whose means of conversation and of record we were not built for. The cost of this arrangement to me was that I saw very little, spending the time chiefly indoors in study, but I thought that there would be ample opportunity for sightseeing to better advantage when I had acquired the means of intellectual intercourse with the inhabitants of the planet. The position was thus when, one day, the spider wrote, or knitted, somewhat as follows. One of our people found a strange weaving near to where your car is. It was fastened to a pole. He did not know that you had come, and he wondered as to its meaning. Perhaps it belonged to your people. I remembered the incident of the annexator's banner and its having been plucked by one of the spider folk. There was another car, I intimated. The people in it put a weaving on a pole for a sign, and one of your people picked it off. The people of that car, who put up the weaving, were so frightened at the sight of your people that they set the car back again into space, and we do not know what has become of them. What was the meaning of the weaving, since it was put for a sign? He inquired. That weaving, I explained, has not a meaning like writing, but it is the custom on the earth to put up such a thing in token that... Here I stopped, for I did not see how to make my meaning clear, but an idea occurred to me, and I proceeded, in token that the person means to put that land in his pocket. The spider looked at me inquiringly. This means, I continued, you put the weaving in your pocket. I cannot get it. I must ask you. Other people, your people, cannot get it. They must ask you. He puts up the weaving on the pole. We cannot dwell on that land. We must ask him. Your people would take away the land, and we would go. Where? Commented the Martian. Are we not a part of this planet? From it our bodies come. To it our bodies go. Not our people, I wrote in reply, but our enemies. But such is the custom on the earth. The earth people are a part of the earth. From it their bodies come, to it their bodies go. Yet they must not use it. It is taken away from them. Is that why you come to Mars? No, the people from whom the land is taken remain on the earth. It is only a few months ago since these cars were invented, but the land has been taken from the dwellers on earth for many generations. How can that be? They ask for land to dwell on, and to those who have taken it from them, they give abundant rich food and much of everything to put in the pocket, continually, in order that day by day the land may not be refused. Are those who take the land and then take the goods instead very strong creatures? Asked the Martian. No, they are people like us. It is only the menfolk who are people on Earth, and there are no creatures equal to them. The spider took his leave. Next day he came back and showed me a notice, copies of which were, he said, in course of being distributed all over the planet to this effect. Whereas some of the inhabitants of the earth are insufferably impudent and the rest incalculably foolish, the safety of the Martians requires that the earth be placed in strict quarantine. I asked whether the quarantine would be relaxed in favor of scientific investigators, but he replied that this question had already been discussed, and both the spiderfolk and the menfolk agreed that scientific knowledge could not be of any use to such unutterable fools, and therefore the motive of scientific research could not be relied on. It was to be mistrusted as a mere pretext. In fact, the Martians did not believe our story about the appropriation of the Earth by the few, and were inclined to suppose it a clumsy fiction intended to let them think we were so little ambitious of territory as to gladly allow ourselves to be dispossessed, whilst in reality we wanted to lull them into a false sense of security preparatory to dispossess them and enslaving them. The habitual submission of the great mass of the people was utterly incredible to them. And whilst they alluded to our folly, they did not believe in it at all, but meant our knavery. Consequently, we had notice to quit, with a warning that if we appeared on the scene again, we might have a rougher reception. There was no help for it. We were hurried to the car and requested to depart forthwith, and we did. Coming away through space, we had at an early stage a danger to encounter. There are two very small moons circling about Mars, and one of them revolves at such a pace that, in fact, it travels more rapidly around Mars than Mars rotates around his own axis, so that whilst the other heavenly bodies, as with us, appear to rise in the east and set in the west, this moon, by reason of its great speed, is seen to rise in the west and set in the east. The satellite is only a few miles in extent and has no atmosphere. We shot past it at such close quarters that we could see its surface far more exactly than one looking from a high window at Port Melbourne can see the Williamstown shore, and we thought that we saw there an object resembling freshly fractured and scratched metal mixed with stones, protruding from a heap of debris at the end of a long groove ploughed out of the rock. We reached the Earth with only similar adventures to those that have been related in connection with the journey away from it, but we never heard any tidings of the Annexator with Sir Mark Solomon and Arcturus G. Fisher since their cowardly flight from the first sight of the spider people when the fatal flag was torn down. Perhaps the object in the debris heap on the Swift satellite may have been the Annexator. The Pioneer would have in all probability left such a groove and debris heap had we collided with the satellite. The End.
I hope you enjoyed the final two chapters of The World's Last Wonder, Loose Ends Tied, Potential Colonists Sent Away, Earth in Quarantine, The Damsel in Distress, Safe, A Great Story. Let's chat with Celeste about it. Modern astronauts spend hours exercising daily just to maintain muscle mass. And here's this author from over a century ago describing similar challenges.
You know what's even more remarkable? The way they portrayed alien communication through the Spider-Martian's web patterns. That's pretty innovative thinking for 1901.
Oh, absolutely. And here's where it gets really interesting. The story suggests humans ended up relating better to these spider-like creatures than to the humanoid Martians. It's like the author was deliberately challenging our assumptions about what makes someone relatable.
That reminds me of recent studies in cognitive science about how we relate to non-human intelligence. we're finding that intelligence can manifest in ways we never expected.
And let's talk about how the story tackles colonialism. When they try explaining the concept of rent to the Martians, well, it's basically holding up a mirror to Earth's own colonial history.
That's exactly what struck me. The parallel to historical colonization is impossible to miss, especially considering the Australian context it seems to reference.
We're about to face these exact same ethical questions with current space exploration. I mean, SpaceX is literally planning Mars colonies, and we still haven't fully addressed these historical issues on Earth.
How do we ensure we don't repeat the same mistakes when we actually start establishing settlements on other planets?
That's where the quarantine aspect becomes so relevant. The Spider Martians essentially put Earth in time out because they recognized our colonizing tendencies. It's like they're saying, you need to work on yourselves before joining the galactic community.
So that could explain the Fermi paradox? Maybe we're under some sort of galactic quarantine right now?
Right. And with estimates suggesting hundreds of millions of potential intelligent civilizations in our galaxy alone, our cosmic silence becomes pretty suspicious.
The way this story manages to address so many contemporary issues is remarkable, from communication barriers to ethical space exploration.
And here's something to consider, the story's treatment of land ownership and rent. By showing these concepts through alien eyes, it forces us to question systems we've just accepted as normal. I mean, when you really think about it, the idea that someone can own a piece of the planet is pretty bizarre.
That's such a crucial point, especially now with the growing wealth gap and housing crisis in many countries.
You know what really stands out? The way the story handles responsibility and intervention. Even if we're not actively participating in colonization, do we have a duty to prevent it? The Spider Martians certainly thought so.
That's particularly relevant now, as private companies start leading space exploration efforts instead of just government agencies.
And looking at our current trajectory, it's almost eerie how many of the story's warnings seem applicable. We're still grappling with the same ethical dilemmas, just with more advanced technology.
Well, at least we have these stories to learn from, if we choose to listen to their warnings.
That's the real question, isn't it? Whether we'll learn these lessons before we actually encounter any Spider Martians who might need to put us in quarantine.
Let's just hope we figure it out before we make first contact. Assuming we haven't already been quarantined, that is.
Thank you, Celeste. Look out for Season 3 of the Vintage Sci-Fi podcast, starting with Issue 13, later in the year. While you're waiting for that, check out the anthology series Alien Dimensions on Amazon. Thank you for listening. It was great to have you.
Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast.